You're listening to Popstar Conversations, taking you inside with your favorite musical artists.
Chuck and I are sitting here with a rocker that helped launch MTV, Billy Idol. Welcome to the show.
Billy, it's so great to have you here with us. You know, we know how important riding motorcycles is to you. Since you had that serious accident, do you still ride?
Yes, I still ride. I've got still got my Harley, my 86 Harley, which I had the accident on. I've still got that. It's perfect. And I've got a Triumph Bonneville T100. It's a 2009. It's not an old bike because I just wanted a really new, super new bike. It's smaller than the Harley, so it's easy around town. And the Harley I use on the highway, you know. When I had the motorcycle accident, I was putting together, a friend of mine was putting together a chopper motorcycle, and he'd got some of the parts, but he hadn't started building it. But when I had the accident, he built the bike while I was in the hospital. So when I got out of the hospital, I had to ride, there's this chopper he's built for me. So he's like, I was going to ride anyway. I was going to keep riding. I would get a little bit scared if I went through a crossway through traffic lights, because you suddenly get this feeling something might come and crash into you or something. But I soon got over that.
Do you belong to a motorcycle club?
Well, there was for a while. There was the Hellfire Canyon Club, Billy Morrison and Steve Jones and a number of his pals. I don't know if they're quite doing that anymore. But still, yeah, I still know a lot of people who ride out there. And so it's quite a lot of people I know still ride, you know. A lot of people stopped riding when the helmet law came in. But in the early 90s, it came in Los Angeles. But Actually, you realize that it's probably just as well to be wearing a helmet, unfortunately. I mean, I loved it, the wind in your hair sort of thing, but it's probably safer to wear a helmet because it is just that one time, and that's why you're wearing it. You know, all bike protection is really for that one time. You know, you're always wearing all this stuff, and it's not for all the time. It's for the one moment you come off, so... So I'm glad now. I always wear a helmet. I'm glad I do. I don't want my brain scrambled. They're bad enough.
This album, Kings and the Queens of the Underground, is it a self-portrait?
A little bit. I mean, I did bounce off the autobiography, the memoir, Dancing with Myself, when writing some of these lyrics, because, it was just their hand in glove. It was easy to do that. And so that very much so, there's a lot of autobiographical things in these songs, yeah. You know, it's just natural when you're writing that to transport them into lyrics a bit. I mean, I could see you start seeing all the pitfalls of your life, really, but with a memoir or whatever, and... Yeah, I mean, I really sort of saw, you know, the sort of depth of my drug addiction and things, which I've been trying to get away from being such a drug addict. It's a lot of fun, but but you end up either dead, mad, or in prison or rehab, and none of those are really very exciting. And well, I really love living for the music, really, and the rock and roll lifestyle and the drugs and everything was just a way to get to the music, really. But, you know, the trouble with drugs is that they compromise your life in the end. There's a honeymoon period with drugs that goes on for a while, and that can sort of help to expand your horizons, or help, in my case, maybe help me to concentrate. I'm a little bit ADD, you know. They didn't have that when I was growing up, but I'm sure they would have said, oh, this child has problems focusing. And of course, drugs a little bit, well, they know today they give people drugs to help them to focus. So I'm sure in the old days, I'm sure I was using drugs to help me to focus in a way, you know. of course, it's not quite the right idea, you know, but I had a lot of fun. I would never sort of say I didn't enjoy those days, because I did. I had a great time. But at the same time, it just came, I saw a time in my life in the 90s, I started to sort of pull back from the sort of, from the edge I was on, because I had children, and they're a big part in making me think, you know, what sort of dad do they want? They don't really want a drug kind of, someone whose brain's been destroyed by drugs. You know, they don't need a compromised father sort of thing. And so the book really helped me to see, you know, a lot of those sort of things that I was right to pull myself together, because I would have ended up dead, mad, or in prison, you know, and I don't think, or rehab. And I didn't like, I went to one rehab for 5 days and I hated it. So I just, that scared the life, AA scared the life out of me, you know, like, it's too horrible, you know, like, I had to get control of my self-control, became a big goal, really, for me, was I wanted to be in control. I wanted to enjoy the rest of my life. I didn't want to be a victim of my own appetites, so to speak.
It doesn't sound like you have any regrets at all.
It's not a regret. I don't regret doing that. It's just I can see the pitfalls of it. I could see a little bit, like, it probably, in some ways, the drugs would have aided the music at some points, but other times they would have interfered with, and possibly, you know, led to, especially in the 90s, a little bit with slowing down of making music, you know, because it just took me quite a while to really get free of the drugs, to where I was in a position to sort of, you know, where I could really sort of, I don't know, I was in a kind of a state where I was controlling myself, where I was in a more disciplined place where I knew what was going to happen next, you know, like, but you're never out of the... you never get away from it, really. I'll always be a drug addict, you know, and I'll always be an alcoholic. I'll always be a sex addict. I'll always be, give me a line, a beer, and you come over here and give me a blowjob. It's that, you know, that's me. But
the whiskey and pills really make
it's really true. I mean, I was kind of looking back at me in the 90s. It's not me today so much, but it was me back in the day. I was a little bit like that. I was glorifying in it. I was having a great time. You really do. I mean, I was having a fantastic time. It's a great way of... I saw it as a way of having a kind of a freedom, sense of freedom. And there is a sense of freedom, but also, yeah, you're kind of chaining yourself at the same time. So it's like a double-edged sword, and in the end, you're going to have to face that and get kind of sort yourself out. Or you'll end up in, you know, in a horrible situation that you won't like at all, and maybe that's no brain or something, or you're alive but with no mind, or you're just... I know a lot of people who, you know, they're just not all there because of drugs and stuff, but they're alive, walking around, but they're not all there. And that, I would hate that to happen to me. I'd hate that to be what I would be saying to my children. This is the way to be, you know. I don't know if that's what I should be telling them, you know. It's one way to be. I don't know if it's the way to be, if you see what I mean.
And what was your turning point?
There was lots of people around me. I was lucky. There's a lot of people around me who are starting to clean up, you know, in one way or another, who are much worse off than I was as well, as drug addicts, you know. And I could see what they were doing, and it just it helped me. That there's people in my group, actually, Steve Stevens and Billy Morrison, who they're very AA. I'm not so much. I'm not sober or anything like that. I still smoke pot and everything like that, but I'm just controlling myself. I don't drink much anymore or anything like that. It's just I had to. I just came to a point where, what did I want, health or death? I had a number of close calls myself, not just a motorcycle accident. That was a big one. But there are other ones, you know, there are other ones throughout my life, really. Once I was looking back on the book, I was going, oh, I could see, oh, There was a wake-up call in 1984, which I didn't listen to. There was a wake-up call in 1990 when I had the motorcycle accident that I didn't completely listen to. But I had a bit of an OD in 1994, and it was after that that when my children were starting to be 4 or 5 years old, and they started to read the newspapers, and also just, being with them. You didn't want to be... I didn't want to be a drug-addicted person with them, so I started to try and clean up. It took me a really long time to get to this stage where I could be sitting here with you now, maybe not having a beer or something. I mean, I might have been in the old days, I might have drunk my way through the interview or something.
What I understand from the album Charmed Life, that album must have cost a fortune considering all the extracurricular activities that were going on.
And that must have been a lot, you know. I mean, I don't even know. I don't want to know. It's scary. Because I can only imagine when I think about it now. Yeah, we must have spent a fortune. It's kind of ridiculous. But, you know, it's a good record. And it sold well and it paid for itself. But, they would have been... We could have made that record, probably the same record, in a much more timely way and enjoyed it just as much. But it was par for the course back then. That's what we were doing. We were living like that. The records were starting to become this... They weren't just about making records. They were starting to become party albums as well. And it was great. We did have a fucking load of fun. And it was, you know, back then you were of the right age to do that.
Let me ask you something.
Do you think that the new generation of rockers care about the music as much as your generation did?
Well, I think that's up to young people now to do that. I love the music. I love what we've done. It's really good. It's really good fun, and it's stood up. You know, because we cared about it at the beginning, it's lasted. You know, we did care. And Keith Forsey was a good enough, great producer, and he made sure the records still sound good today. That was one of the things we really cared, you know. And despite we were having a lot of fun making the records, but we really cared. That's why we got into it in the first place. That's what punk rock was really all about. It was actually, you really cared. You know, you really cared about the music, the way people cared about music, about what it meant to us in society, what it meant to us as a culture.
The title of this album, is it a homage to your rebellious past?
It is a bit of it's actually my kind of story, but it is a tribute to all the people from that time who aren't with us and some who are, and to all those people who kind of came through that time, and really they added to that time, their attitude, their feeling about it. It's just as much what drove me as my own feelings. It was my own feelings and the people around me, the people who cared. And we cared enough about music and rock and roll and everything to want to give it a kick in the ass. That's what was... I think it was important that we did say... It's time for a change. It's time to reboot the system. It's time to kick it up the ass. And that was super important. And I think the no Elvis, Beatles and Rolling Stones was a massive statement the Clash made to kind of distance ourselves. And we did too, Generation X. We did Your Generation kind of saying. But, you know, when me and Tony James really thought about it, we had to say, you know, but we grew up with those groups. And when they started, like Elvis, when he began, was incredible. And his Sun Sides still stand up today. And the Beatles, when they started out, were great. I mean, they were a great band. And so were the Stones. And it wasn't what they turned into or anything. We loved what they started out like, what they cared. And, you know, the reason we cared was partly because they cared. I mean, so, but I think it was just in 1977, it was so important to say, we need year one again. You know, we need to clear the slate. We need back to year one. We have to reboot the system. We have to act as if it's not happened before, or we have to act as if we need a fresh energy. And that was one way of doing it. And I believed in it. But I just knew as well that, you know, I'd grown up, I'd bought Beatle records. When I was six and a half, I bought She Loves You. I started by I Love the Beatles. So I loved what rock and roll meant. So it wasn't that we loved rock and roll, really, and punk rock was now a new version of it.
What all that was going on in your life and moving to the U.S., your life, it must have changed drastically.
I could have stayed in England, and who knows what would have happened. It's very easy in England to end up redundant, you know, like because a lot of people, things happen so quickly in England that it's, you know, you can soon become passé, you know, very quickly people get, well, he's already happened, or, you know, he's over or whatever. I don't know that we've seen him, you know, they want something new. So I could have stayed in England, but it seemed a lot more exciting to go somewhere fresh, somewhere that I got a lot of inspiration from, somewhere the scene had come from, New York. A lot of the scene that we dug, the Velvet Underground, the New York Dolls, it was all from New York. And it seemed like a sort of a mirror kind of place where there'd be just a kind of energy that you're looking for. And also where they did have they were versed in punk rock, but it hadn't gone mega there like it had in England. So it was one of the few places I could think of going, and it spoke English, where I could think of going to where, you know, I might get a fresh start. And also, I may meet a really, you know, I needed to find an incredible guitar player. And I had an American manager, Bill O'Coin, and he was telling me he thought if I came to New York as well, he thought that we could find the right person, and he already knew Steve Stevens, and he turned out to be perfect. So it was kind of like it was a dangerous time, it was a scary time for me to make that move. You know, I didn't know what was going to happen, but I had this fantastic. I went, you know, first few months I was in New York in 1980, 81, or whatever it was, March 81. I went for that summer where I was really trying to work out, you know, what I should be doing. You know, we'd done Dancing With Myself in England, and we'd done the Gen X album in England, but I sort of didn't completely 100% know what music I was going to do. You know, I was a little bit, I was wondering, you know, what's Billy Idol going to be about? You know, I really loved Dancing With Myself, but I wasn't sure about America. I didn't really know. I mean, America was into REO Speedwagon. It was all these very high-pitched. It was very sort of bland rock and roll that was kind of going on in America. So I couldn't see how I would fit into that at all. You know, I was going, how would I? So I was, at first, I was a little bit, you know, I was having a little bit of, I was wondering exactly what to do. But then one night, after I was only there a couple of months, I went to this uptown club, Hurrah's. It was somewhere on West 80s, somewhere there. And it had, like, it was a very small club, but it had, like, a dance, very small dance floor, and around the dance floor, a load of couches and tables. And then there was a bar over here looking at the these couches and tables and dance floor, but there's nobody on the dance floor, nobody. I mean, maybe there's one, but there's nobody, actually. That's what I remember. Everyone was out around the bar. Most people were either in these couches or standing around this bar, smoking, drinking. You know, I couldn't even, I was trying to get a drink, you know, like, oh, finally, all right, can I have a screwdriver? Thank you, you know. So I was sort of drinking my screwdriver, and then suddenly I realized, hey, everybody's disappeared from around the bar, you know, and they weren't just disappearing from around the bar, they were running. They were running, pushing the couches and kind of armchairs over to get to the dance floor. And the whole club was on the dance floor. You know, where there's everybody around the bar. It was just me on my own standing there at the bar. And I went like, what the fuck's happened? And then I sort of went, I wonder what then I sort of listened to And I listened to what the DJ was playing, and I realized, oh my God, he's playing Dancing With Myself. I don't have to change a thing. I don't have to find anything new. I've already got the thing. This tells me I'm these American kids right here dancing in this club, 1981, are telling me, this is what you've got to, you're already doing the right music, man. You know, like, it was a great moment for me. It was such a breakthrough that I went, this is fantastic, because I didn't want to change. I believed in the Dancing With Myself music. I believed in that. I believed in that song, and I was a little sad it hadn't taken off in England, that the last version of Gen X hadn't taken off, and that me and Tony had had to break up or whatever. But when I saw that, I went, this is fantastic, because this is what I wanted to believe. I didn't have to change myself. There wasn't anything wrong with what I was doing. It was just the nature of England at that time. They weren't going to embrace this new version of me when they only just, you know, found, you know, they just weren't going to do it that easily. But there was the answer, and the answer was what I was already doing. It was so great. Then the next move I made was, well, how could I follow up this? So obviously, like, I realized that Dancing With Myself was doing quite well on this. There was an underground dance chart in New York. There was kind of an I don't know what it was called. It's called something, but it's like an underground dance chart with what records were being played in clubs. And I started to realize that, God, Dancing With Myself is one of these. Like, I would go to Danceteria or someone like that, and they would play it for 20 minutes. You know, they keep putting it on. They keep mixing it back in, so that for 20 minutes or half an hour, people were dancing the Dancing With Myself. It was, I went, all I've got to do right now, man, the only thing you fucking got to do is follow it up.
Billy, how did you follow it up?
Well, it was at first I came up with this idea, because I'd worked with Keith Forsey, and he was a drummer, primarily a drummer, a producer drummer. I suddenly thought, I just need to follow this. I need to follow Dancing With Myself up. And that's when I thought to myself, I wonder if I thought about doing Money Money, because I thought, with such a drum song. And I phoned Keith Forsey up and said, do you fancy doing a remake of Money Money? And he went, yeah, all right. I said, it's kind of a drum song, and, you know, you'd record, produce it incredible. And he said, it's a great idea. Come out to Los Angeles and we'll do we'll do a version of Dancing With Money Money. And we did it. And I went to the Ritz in New York on 11th Street there, downtown. And I got the DJ. Oh, it was an off night. It was an off dance night in the Ritz. They had a dance night on a Tuesday night. And it was kind of a similar thing. You know, there's just a few people on the dance floor, no one going mad or anything like that. The DJ's playing music, and there's just a couple of people dancing. Most people were sitting around the edge of this dance floor. And I got him to put Money Money on, and in a second, everybody came out from the corner of the, doing all the 60s dances. And I went, that's it, it's doing it. It's following up dancing, it's creating the same effect. And I just went on from there. And then, of course, what happened was, because I'd done Money Money, I needed a group. I needed some musicians now to start putting together a band. And I'd met Steve Stevens through Bill O'Coyne. And I asked him, basically, look, man, I don't know what's going to happen between you and me, but help me to put a band together, because I need a group. You know, if you want to stay in it, if you don't, fantastic. But, you know, let's start off just help me put a band together, kind of thing. And if you want to stay in it, great. And if you decide you don't, I get it. You know, it's cool. But we've stayed together for a long time now, so.
Your next album, Devil's Playground, it was recorded after a 13-year break. Why so long?
Well, we actually tried to do, there was a couple of false starts on records. We nearly did a record with Glenn Ballard as the producer, and we actually got three quarters of the way along with that when the record company, you know, because of the problems the record companies were starting to have, the record business was dissolving, was falling apart. By 1998-1999, they were starting to not be able to fund things how they wanted to, and they actually pulled the plug on the album we were making. So A Bitter Pill was one of the songs that was going to be on it. which is on this record, actually. Finally, I finally recorded a version of it that we liked enough to be able to put out. And so, there was a lot of false starts. And eventually, though, we did make Devil's Playground with Keith Forsey in the end. And we had a number of false starts, and that's just the nature of the music business was changing so rapidly and falling apart, and it was difficult to, it wasn't so easy to get funding for your music and stuff.
In your best-selling book, Dancing With Myself, you really exposed yourself, didn't you?
I think the thing was that really, if I worked with a ghostwriter, that it was only going to turn into, I don't know, it wasn't going to be so personal. In a way, I just could see that if I did it myself, it would be, in and of itself, it would be an artistic process, rather like making records or doing anything I've done. And sort of break a new, bit of a new frontier, and It seemed like a lot of fun. It was like extending the lyric side of myself into prose writing a little bit. And who else could tell my story? You know, and no one else can tell it better than me, really. I mean, I also know that, you know, at some point, there's bound to be somebody who's going to do a biography, or not just of me, but of Generation X or whatever, and or Billy Idol or whatever, and they can go around and get all the stories from everybody else, but who's going to truly get the story from me? I'm going to give you the story. So that's why I sort of ended up doing it myself, and there is definitely a cachet today in doing it yourself. A lot of people want to read the books written by the artist. You know, you're getting it straight from me. So I think there's sides of this book that a biographer wouldn't be able to find out, and he'd only have to ask me anyway, and this way there it is.
Billy, thank you very much. This has been incredible.
Thank you.
Billy, thank you for the interview.
Thank you again for listening to Popstar Conversations. Be sure to click the subscribe button below and hit the red bell so that you'll be notified of our next exclusive interview.
Thank you for listening to Popstar Conversations. Please join us again for another conversation with your favorite musical artist.